So, Happy New Year. 2017 went by very fast, and they seem like they go by faster all the time. Whenever I say that to somebody that's older than I am, they say, oh yeah, well, it keeps going faster and faster. Seems like that's kind of a common refrain, that the years just keep going by, and they gain momentum. And this is the time of year where people tend to reevaluate what they're doing. They look at their priorities. They examine kind of the past year and project into this following year and start to make plans, make resolutions. I generally don't make resolutions, but I have for a few years now put together a list of priorities and a list of projects to focus on. And that kind of helps somewhat for me to focus my attention. I have many, many, many projects, and it's very difficult for me to narrow it down and just focus on a few things. And so this is kind of a helpful exercise for me to just make a short list. And then I try to just focus on those things and not get too distracted with other projects. I can't say that I have been very successful at it, but I am getting better at it. So this time of year is when I tend to do that sort of thing, and I'm sure that's probably true for you, where you start to evaluate and think about what you're doing. And it got me thinking about the second coming, the fact that when Jesus comes back, he's going to reward and he's going to judge. And we should all be thinking about that as we're making our plans for this year. As we're sitting down and looking at 2018 and thinking about what do we want to be doing, what should we be doing, we should be thinking about what we're doing in that light, that the Lord is going to come back, and he's going to ask us what we've done, and he's going to judge what we've done. And so this raises some important questions. It reminds me of a passage in James. I'll have you turn there to James chapter 5. We won't be staying there, but we're just going to make a quick visit there to James. There's this one verse that every time I read it, it reminds me of this event, this story that happened in my life way back, and it's kind of embarrassing to tell, but it's been long enough, it's been over 40 years since it happened, so I can actually tell it without being completely embarrassed. I guess we'll find out. I don't generally tell this in public. But in chapter 5, verse 7, here's what he says. He says, "Be patient then, brothers, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its valuable crop and how patient he is for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm because the Lord's coming is near. Don't grumble at each other, brothers, or you will be judged. The judge is standing at the door." And it's this idea of the judge standing at the door that makes me think of this one event. When I was born, I was the oldest grandchild on my dad's side, and so I had kind of a prime position. I had a position of honor as the oldest grandson. And I enjoyed that position for some time, until my sister came along. Now, I did have some cousins in between there, but when my sister was born, it kind of changed things for me in a way that I did not like. She was getting a lot of attention, and all of a sudden, I felt like that was attention that should be mine, and she was taking this away from me, and I did not like that. And I don't know exactly how it transpired, but she must have gotten in trouble for something, and I liked that. I liked that she was kind of getting some, you know? And so I wanted to perpetuate this. And so what I did was, my sister and I shared a room. And we had a pocket door. It was just a pocket door that would slide. And there was a toy box that was beneath kind of a little alcove next to the door. And then my sister had her crib, and I had my bed. And what I did was I went and got a stuffed animal, and I put it in her crib, and then I went out, and I told my mom and dad that she had gotten out of her bed and gotten that toy. And so she got in trouble, and I relished this. But evidently it wasn't enough. She didn't get in enough trouble for me. I wasn't satisfied. So I did it again. And I can't actually remember how many times I did it. But I remember distinctly the last time. So here's what I remember. This must have been the third or fourth time, and she had been getting in trouble, but I was not satisfied by this. I was evidently going to milk this to infinity. I don't know what I was thinking. I didn't have the sense to stop at well enough. So I went to go to the toy box, and just as I was grabbing the stuffed animal, that pocket door slid open, and my mom said, "What are you doing?" And I don't know if I skipped a beat or not, but I just pretty much lied on spot. I said, the stuffed animal had fallen down, and I was picking it up to put it back in the toy box. And she said, "No, you weren't. I was standing here at the door watching you." And I knew I was completely busted. The judge was standing at the door. And so whenever I read that, I sort of think about that idea of that pocket door, just shh, what are you doing? And every time I read James, that comes up. I remember that story. It reminds me of a verse actually in Matthew 24 where we're going to be spending our time today. So I'd like for you to turn back there. And there's a very similar verse. And I'm not going to be talking a lot about the second coming. This chapter 24 actually covers a couple of different events. It covers some events that happened way back in 70 AD, and it also covers events that happened in the second coming, and it can be kind of hard to tease those out. And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but I just wanted you to read and hear this similar type of idea of the judges at the door. And this is what Jesus says in chapter 24, verse 32. He says, "Now learn this lesson from the fig tree. As soon as its twigs get tender and its leaves come out, you know that summer is near. Even so, when you see all these things, you know that it is near right at the door." And this is how Jesus talks about the second coming. He talks about it in such a fashion that you should be ready for that pocket door to slide open, and the Lord's going to ask you, "What are you doing?" And you should probably be in a position where you don't have your hand in the toy box, right? So my question for you today is, what will you be doing when he comes? When Jesus shows up in all his glory, what will he find you doing? Will you be doing something that you will be happy to be doing at that time? Or will you be doing something that you're not so happy to be doing? Now, I certainly in the year 2017 have done some of both. I've done some things that I would really not want to be doing when the Lord returns. And I'm sure you probably can think of some things that fit that category for you. And I also have done some things in 2017 that I would want to be doing when the Lord comes back. But my challenge today is to be thinking about that when you're making your decisions about what you're doing, so that you're doing more of the things that you want to be doing when he comes and fewer of those things that you don't want to be doing when he comes. So let's talk a little bit about what we know about when Jesus returns. We'll skip ahead there to verse 36. And this is what Jesus says, because the disciples ask, when will these things happen? And what will be the sign of the end of the age? And Jesus says this, in verse 36, "No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." Wow. You know, that should give pause to anybody who tries to set dates. I remember back in the early 90s, there was a particular preacher who was setting dates, and he had set... Well, there was kind of this history of setting dates in the late 80s, right? There was a book called 88 Reasons Why Jesus Will Return in 1988. There was a follow-up the following year called 89 Reasons Why Jesus Will Come in 1989. It seemed like, whoever put that together didn't learn their lessons for the first version. But there have been people setting dates, you know, throughout the history of the church, and so far they've all been wrong. And so Jesus tells us that not even the Son knows. Now, Jesus, in his earthly life, lived like we do, dependent on the Holy Spirit for his revelation. And there were some things that the Father held back. Now, Jesus has ascended to the right hand of the Father, and I'm pretty sure that Jesus now does actually know the day and the hour. But none of us do. We do not know the day or the hour. And this is what Jesus says it will be like. He says, as in the days of Noah, so it will be in the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. Two men will be in a field, one will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill, one will be taken and the other left. So in the days of Noah, Noah preached to them about this flood that was going to happen. But nobody believed it except for Noah's family. And they were actually brought into the ark before the flood came. And it sounds like an angel sealed the door, or God sealed them in before the flood. And then the flood happened, right? And all of them had an opportunity to go and be in that ark. There's this beautiful ark that's being built. It had been built over a period of 100 years. There was probably a lot of buzz. You know, a lot of people had probably gone out just to see that big construction that Noah was building and possibly make fun of him and maybe poke the animals or whatever, you know. But very few people entered into the ark. And then it started to rain. And you can probably imagine that when huge drops of rain started falling from the sky, people started to think, oh, wait, there's a boat and we're not in it. Right? And you kind of wonder if maybe they didn't start, you know, run in that direction and start pounding on the side of the ark or something. But they could have been inside. They were caught off guard. They didn't believe it would happen, and so they were not ready for it. And Jesus says, the coming of the Son of Man will be like that. So this is what he says. Therefore, keep watch. This is verse 42. Keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come. But understand this. If the owner of the house had known at what time the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Right? So we don't know the time. So the idea is that because we don't know the day or the hour, we should be ready all the time. Because at any time, we could be surprised. Right? So it should color the way that we spend our time. It should affect the way that we make our decisions about what we're doing and what we're not doing. And so this is what he says in verse 45. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them their food at the proper time? Actually, I would ask you that question. Who are the servants who God has put in charge to give everyone else their food at the proper time? I would propose that that is the church at large. That's all of us. We're all here to do the master's will for the sake of the world until he returns. And this is what he says, it will be good for that servant whom the master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. So the idea is that if we're doing the things that we've been given to do, when Jesus comes back, he's going to give us more and greater things to do. This is sort of like the trial run or the practice for the bigger things. And we don't know what those bigger things are, but if we're doing the small things now, we'll get bigger things to do later. But then he says this, but suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, my master is staying away a long time. And he then begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with drunkards. The master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he is not aware of. He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. There will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the second coming will be good news for many people, and it will be bad news for many people. And it really depends on if they're doing what they're supposed to be doing or not. They could be in big trouble when the judge opens that door, right? And then Jesus gives us some parables to underscore this and give us an idea of what this is like, and some touchstones that will help us remember this idea. The first he gives us is the parable of the 10 virgins. And they used to do weddings differently than we do back in those times. What they would do is, if you were getting married and you were a groom, you would go to your mom and dad's place and you would build an extension onto their house or somewhere on their land. The idea is that you would be preparing a place where you already have space to. You would be preparing for a family there. You'd be preparing a room for you and your bride and future family. And that took some time. But once you were done doing that, you would, you know, let everybody know that you were approaching the completion of that, and that it was imminent that you were going to be coming back and getting married, and then bring your bride back to that place that you had prepared for her. And so everybody would know the day, basically, that this is going to happen, or close to it, but they wouldn't necessarily know the hour. And they would do this on purpose, so there was this idea of surprise and anticipation. And the bride really wouldn't know when the groom is going to show up. And so the idea is that her and her friends are going to be ready whenever he shows up. And that's kind of the context of the parable that we have here. He says, "At that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. The foolish ones took their lamps but did not take any oil with them. The wise, however, took oil jars along with their lamps. The bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep." So notice this kind of fits with the idea of the servant who says, "My master's a long time coming." And he gets really relaxed with how he's treating the other servants. He starts to, you know, eat or drink with drunkards and beat the other servants. And same thing with these virgins. The bridegroom had taken a long time coming, and so they got drowsy. They fell asleep, but some of them had not prepared in advance. They would have a long pole, and they would have a small lamp on top of it that was a reservoir of oil, and you would fill that with oil and light it, and then you would be able to raise that up, and you'd be able to shine the way for the bridegroom to come. And being smaller vessels, they didn't burn a lot, so you could fill yours up, and it could burn out, and you'd have to replenish your oil. Well, the foolish virgins, I don't know where they thought they would get the oil, or if they thought maybe the bridegroom would not be long in coming, or I'm not sure what they thought, but they did not do what the wise virgins did and bring a jar of oil. They were underprepared, and so here's what happens. "At midnight, the cry rang out, 'Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him.' Then all the virgins woke up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish ones said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil. Our lamps are going out.' 'No,' they replied, 'there may not be enough for both us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves.' But while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the others also came. 'Sir, sir,' they said, 'open the door for us.' But he replied, 'I tell you the truth, I don't know you. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour.'" So they were not prepared. The bridegroom comes. They are out trying to buy their oil, right? It kind of reminds me of people who sort of get this idea that, you know, I've said that prayer, and so I'm good with Jesus, but I'm not really concerned about cleaning my life up or making any major changes until, you know, I kind of get closer to that time. They sort of get the idea that they can do the minimum and that will be enough for them to be prepared when the Lord returns. And Jesus challenges this idea. He says, you need to have extra oil so that whenever the bridegroom shows up, you're ready. And you have plenty of oil to light the way for him. You can't get some from the other virgins, right? You can't appeal to them and say, "Hey, I want some of your oil." You need to have your own. And it's probably not a good thing if you have to go out and get the oil when the bridegroom is there, right? That's too late. So do it in advance of the bridegroom showing up. And then Jesus tells a second parable, which is a little different. It has a little different flavor to it, but it has some of the same kind of idea, and it gives us the same kind of challenge. And here's what he says. He says, again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one, he gave 5 talents of money, to another, 2 talents, and to another, 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. So just a little word on talents. This word talents actually is a measurement. It's a weight measurement. And it's this use of the word talent that actually, and this parable that made the word talent mean gifting, right? So the Lord, or this master gave his servants these gifts, of gold. And we now think of talents as being things that we've been gifted. So we've been given music, for example, as a talent, right? We talk about talents in that regard. And I think that's an appropriate way to think about this. We're not all just given bags of gold. We're given many, many things that the Lord expects us to use for his kingdom, use for his purposes. And so all of us, really, if we were to think about the things that we've been given, are rich. Now, I want to give you a sense of the amount of money that he's talking about. Because when I read this, when I've read this in the past, I've always thought about just like coins. Like he gave the one 10 talents. And I think like a handful of 10 coins. But it's actually the equivalent, a talent is the equivalent of 20 years of a day wage earner's earnings. So a day wage earner, somebody who just works hour to hour for a living, right, doing manual labor or whatever, just the average worker, you take that guy and he works for 20 years and he amasses 1 talent. So it's actually a measurement. Let me read this. This is from, I wanted to see what the equivalent today would be in dollars. So this is as of 2016. I just Googled how much is a biblical talent. Some authorities say that the talent typically weighed about 33 kilograms, which is 75 pounds, varying from 20 to 40 kilograms. In February 2016, the international price of gold was U.S. $1,190 per troy ounce. 1 gram costs about $38. At this price, a talent of 33 kilograms would be worth about $1.25 million. One talent. $1.25 million. So you could almost say million, right? He gave to one 5 million, and he gave to the other 2 million, and he gave to the other 1 million based upon his ability. What this should do for us, it should underscore that the Lord has richly blessed all of us according to our ability. He's given us all valuable things. It's not just about money. Money is just a mechanism in the parable for us to understand the economics of it. But he's given us all blessings. And that does include material wealth. Some people in our body are givers. They have the gift of giving, and they may be blessed with material wealth. Others of us are gifted with talents, gifted with abilities, skills, right? The gift of singing, the ability to make music. Those are certainly things that the Lord has given us and wants us to use. So, after a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 million, I'm just changing the wording here a little bit, brought the other 5 million. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 million. See, I have gained 5 million more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with the 2 talents also came. Master, you entrusted me with 2 million. See, I have gained 2 million more. His master said, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. So far the story's going pretty well. But we know that the third servant just took it and buried it, right? So all he's going to have is that million at the end, and he's going to give it back. Let's see what happens to him. He says, then the man who had received the 1 million came. Master, he said, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you have not sown and gathering where you have not scattered seed. So I was afraid, and I went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have even what he has will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Wow. He gave back the million, but the master's upset. The master's upset because at least he could have put it in the bank. He knew that he wanted a return, right? He even said, I knew that you were a hard master and that you reap where you don't sow. Like you expect profit. And yet he didn't even put the money to as simple use as putting it in the bank. And the master's upset. So what does that mean for us? Well, it means that we should be doing something for the master with the gifts that he's given us. Those are his gifts, and he expects a return of some kind from those. And we all have to evaluate in our own lives what those things are. For Amanda and I, we were blessed fairly recently with a home, with a house. And I've kind of wondered how that would be put to use. And my initial thought was just, wow, this is awesome, I have a house. And I started thinking about all the things I could do that would be awesome, having a house and some land. And certainly have started, you know, putting that to use for my own benefit. But also the Lord has kind of put to me the challenge, well, what are you going to do with this for me? And so that has been on my mind. Something that we have been doing is doing our young adults Bible study, and we do that in our home. And so we've started seeing our home put to the master's use, and that's been a real blessing to see that take place. I feel like it's now more the Lord's home, right, than my home. So, one final parable, and this, I think, should give us the idea of what kind of things the master is looking for us to do. It's not about money. He's used money as a parable, but now he gives us this parable about the sheep and the goats, and I want you to pay particular attention to what he wants from the sheep and the goats and why he designates some as sheep and some as goats, because this should give us an idea of what the Lord is looking for, what kinds of things he's concerned about, where his heart is. When the Son of Man comes in his glory and the angels with him, he will sit on his throne in heavenly glory. All the nations will be gathered before him, and he will separate the people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. He will put the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Does it strike you that list is different than what you sort of picture the judgment to be like. I don't always think of the judgment in these types of terms, that the Lord's criteria is that we clothed and fed and visited and welcomed, right? Those are all relational type of things. Those are all things that you do to people who are in need, people who can't repay you, right? It's what's interesting is the Lord wants us to make a profit, but he wants to do it by giving to people who can't pay us back, right? So it kind of puts it on its head. Now, here's the good news and the bad news is some of these are sheep and some of them are goats. And what's tricky about this is that some of the goats thought they were sheep and some of the sheep thought they were goats. They had different criteria than the master did. And I want you to notice what their criteria is, what they think is going to be judged. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you? The king will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers of mine, you did for me. Then he will say to those on his left, depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, and you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, and you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, and you did not look after me. They will also answer, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or needing clothes or sick or in prison, and we did not help you? He will reply, I tell you the truth, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. So what they don't realize is the way they treat other people is the way that Jesus evaluates how they treat him. And they did not treat people well. They thought they were doing good for God, but they weren't doing good for human beings who are created in God's image. And so they kind of missed the boat there. And some of them even went on to ask, when did we do these things? They weren't even aware that they had done them. Notice that the righteous aren't even aware that they've been doing these things for the Lord because they're busy doing these things for people, right? They're kind of surprised that the Lord is going to reward them for the things that they've done for the needy, right? So it should give us an idea of what kinds of things the Lord wants us to do, what kind of reward or what kind of profit he wants, right? He wants for us to draw people in through love, through feeding them, through being kind to them, by treating them well, by clothing them. That's how he increases his kingdom, through love. So, that gives me, that gives me a different picture of what kinds of things I should be doing with my time. I don't tend to think in those terms, right? I don't tend to think as those things as productive, right? I think of other things as being productive. There's a lot of things I think, oh, I should do this because it's going to be a good thing. It's going to be productive. But I don't think of clothing people and loving people and feeding people as, a profitable thing. But Jesus says it's a tremendous profit, and we can see from the different parables that he will put us in charge of many things if we're just doing those types of things. And who knows what kinds of things that means, right? Kind of might blow your mind a little bit when you think that the things that he's given us in this life are equivalent to millions of dollars. And that, he says, is a few things. I put you in charge of a few things. So now be in charge of many things. What will that be in the future? We don't know. We don't know what many things, but we're in preparation here for great things. and there are great things we're going to be in charge of. And the way that God is going to evaluate what things we get to do, what things we're going to be put in charge of, our responsibilities in the future life, in the afterlife, are based upon what we do here in the small things that we have, the way that we treat other people. So I would like to ask you some questions, and I would like for you to take some time on your own to ask yourself these questions. And they go like this: what do you want to be doing when he comes?
Reading the Bible.
That's great, reading the Bible, excellent. What do you not want to be doing when he comes? You don't have to tell me that one. You can keep that one private. That's between you and the Lord. What do you not want to be doing, right? And be moving your priorities and your energy and your focus toward those things that you want to be doing when he comes and away from those things that you do not want to be doing when he comes. And finally, I would like just to paint a little bit of a picture of what it would be like if all of us were doing this, if all of us were devoting our time and energy to these things. I know something that I notice being in this area is there's a lot of people that are hurting. There's a lot of people that are in bondage. They're in a prison. You know, there are a lot of people who have great need, who are going hungry at times, who are thirsty at times, who need to be clothed, and that looks different for different people, right? And in winter, being clothed might be especially important, right? There are people who might just be without firewood, right? That would be a form of being clothed and cold, and so providing heat in winter, right? We need to be thinking about those types of things, and if all of us here and all of the believers in this area, in the surrounding area, and Sweet Home and surrounding area, we're doing that. If we were devoting our time and attention to those types of things, we could make a very visible difference in our area. We could be helping people out of bondage. We could be seeing people that are becoming more productive in their lives because we've freed them up from things. We've freed them up from concerns that maybe they don't need to be concerned about. They can be concerned about other things. So we could make a huge difference if we just were faithful in the few things that Jesus has given us to be responsible for. And he's going to come back, and he's going to open that door, and he's going to say, "What are you doing?" And we should all be able to give him an answer that causes him to say, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into my happiness."